Hi, this is Kenny
and Amanda Smith from Nashville, Tennessee.
Keep it right here on WRCT Pittsburgh.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, at some point we will get tired of hearing news reports about record heat. because the records will continue to be broken, and heat will have stopped meaning what it once may have meant. Media play a role in moving us from questions about where to buy a good air conditioner to what stands in the way of addressing what is a public health catastrophe. One obstacle is utility companies. In February of last year, we spoke with Shelby Green at the Energy and Policy Institute and with Selah Goodson-Bell at the Center for Biological Diversity about their research on that topic. We'll hear that again today on the show. Also on the show, some listeners will know that veteran labor organizer and author Jane McAlevey died recently. The attributes are coming in, but I have little doubt in saying that McAlevey would care less for attention to her life than to those of the people she worked for, inside and outside of labor unions. Counterspin spoke with her in 2018 when the Me Too campaign was coming to fore, and we'll hear that again this week on the show. That's coming up this week on Counterspin. Some Texans are being told it could take many days to restore power in the wake of Hurricane Beryl, which left many people in the dark and in the heat. You could say it is what it is, but many people are not doing that, and instead asking why utility providers are so insufficiently up to the task of doing what it is that they are empowered to do. We talked about that question last year with Shelby Green from the Energy and Policy Institute and Selah Goodson-Bell from the Center for Biological Diversity. And I started by asking them about their recent report, which was called Powerless. Let's just get into the content of the report. What do you mean by powerless? What is the problem that you're describing? And, you know, I think a lot of folks might think, oh, my lights blink out for a minute. Losing power is much, much more than that. And it's life or death in some cases. Yes.
Yeah, that's well said. Zoom out a little bit. I just wanted to share that this report is the third in a series that's been tracking this issue, specifically the extent to which profit-driven utilities have been cutting off families' basic human right to electricity and heat millions of times a year, while at the same time shelling out billions to their shareholders and executives. We started tracking this in the pandemic, but it's a pretty egregious injustice and has continued since. It's still happening today. Most recently, we've seen that about 5.7 million houses were cut off of electricity about 5.7 million times since 2020. And that's a low-end number, as about 20 states don't even provide information on household disconnections. And that's about 40% of states that we found. And so all of the numbers and figures we're going to share today are just a small scope of the issue. They don't represent the full scope. And that's also going to be something we talk about a little bit more, data transparency. And at the heart of our report, it's basically a desire to expose the utility industry's greedy profiteering that's ultimately driving the shutoffs crisis and energy insecurity.
Well, I wanted to just actually, you very forward in the report, connect electric and gas service shutoffs and profiteering. And I think there's a reason that you connect those two things.
Yeah, I think most consumers really don't realize what is happening when it comes to their utility bill or the energy system that we have designed in America. Most utilities, they're able to get a rate of return from their customers, and they're not really concerned about providing power or ensuring that everyone has access to power. They're more concerned about making sure they're making enough money to give to their shareholders. And so what we really wanted to highlight within this report is that not only are disconnections happening across the country, especially during a time where people are experiencing such high economic uncertainty, but they are also happening because of rising prices of gas. And utilities are heavily reliant on gas and are building infrastructure and gas-fired power plants that will cause utility bills to increase further and also cause customers to have to pay for these rate increases. And so we really wanted to make the connection between consumers, the price of their utility bill, and also this model that is in need of reform in America.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that's not a connection that mainstream news media are making. In other words, we're hearing prices are rising and that's hurting you, but we're not necessarily connecting that to profit making by utility corporations. And so I appreciate the connection that you're making there. But I just wonder if you could spell out, like, we're not talking about a few more pennies at the pump. We're talking about, you know, in many cases, this is about whether people can do what they need to do to survive.
I think framing it that way is really important. People seem to take for granted how important electricity is for physical safety, for food security, you know, keeping your food refrigerated, for medical care if you have medicine that needs to be refrigerated, and also for telecommunications. And with the nexus of disconnects and arrearages, when people are forced to bear those costs and have their service severed, it makes it also harder for them to maintain employment. It makes it harder for them to keep their kids in school. It can make it more difficult to get a loan or a mortgage. And so we really wanted to highlight how this energy insecurity issue just has tendrils into other ways that social instability can manifest, and how the utility industry is really complicit in that. And of course, the impacts of this are most disproportionately felt in households of color. We found that last year, 1 in 5 American households struggled to pay for an energy bill, but that rate was 50% higher for households of color. And a big reason has to do with some of the lingering impacts of redlining. And basically, a lot of households of color might live in structurally deficient housing that ends up costing more to keep warm or cool, which is especially costly and dangerous in the wake of climate disasters like heat waves, freezes, et cetera. They're already hit the hardest and are less likely to get the resources they need as early as they need. But then when it comes to the increases in energy demand that come with coping from those extreme weather disasters, we're seeing households of color also in the short end of the stick. So that's something that we also wanted to highlight and really show the utility industry's role in that factor. And again, like Shelby said, since they're continuing to invest in fossil gas infrastructure and are completely disconnected from the implications of that, that itself is also exacerbating the climate emergency.
And just to bring it back to profits for a minute, disconnections across the country, as we outlined in the report, occurred over 1.5 million times in just the first 10 months of 2022. If just 12 utilities took 1% of their dividends that they paid out to shareholders, that could have covered the cost. That could have prevented disconnections. But now they're also passing on the cost of rising fuel to their customers through rate increases for fuel rider adjustments. So utility executives, they are not doing their part in making sure that they're keeping the cost low for consumers. They're not doing their part in making sure that consumers that fall behind can get access to relief dollars. And they're also not doing their part in communicating properly why consumers' utility bills are going up. Mm-hmm. So there's a really big problem here with utilities. They're not really providing the public with an affordable or a reliable service. And regulators, public service commissions, are not doing a good enough job requiring utilities to do that. So there really is this broken system where the consumer gets hurt every single time. And so we really wanted to highlight in this report that you're not alone when you say that you can't afford your utility bill or when you say that you have to use your credit card to pay for an essential service. There are millions of people across the country who are having that same plight. And we need to start looking at utilities and their regulators and how they are able to uphold this system that hurts the everyday American.
Let me ask you both in terms of journalists, because it seems like you're in another world in some ways than the way corporate media discuss things. This kind of conversation is largely off the page. And so I would like to ask you both. Obviously, folks who are media consumers are also the same folks who might have their lights shut off, but then they pick up the paper and the paper tells them what the problem is and what the solution is. And I would like to ask you both, what would you have journalists do? Who would you have them talk to? What questions would you have them ask that could turn this conversation around to the point where we're not at like, oh, I guess Russia or I guess COVID. How do we reorient folks to the conversation that might change things?
I think where journalists can start is just going up to people in parking lots or people at the park, asking them, have you looked at your utility bill lately? Have you noticed any changes in your utility bill? When I first started learning about shut-off and utility bills, that's what I did. I had a petition. I went to the park. I was asking people if they've noticed a difference in their utility bill, if they've accrued any debt during the pandemic. And I was asking them to sign a petition to make sure my city extended a moratorium so people didn't lose power. So where journalists can start is just start talking to everyday people and get them to look at things that they've stopped looking at potentially. Not a lot of people look at the fees or charges that are hidden within their utility bill. And so one example is, like I mentioned earlier, fuel riders. When the cost of methane gas is increasing, you will see that reflected in the fuel rider adjustment charge. And so, yeah, I would just encourage journalists to get everyday residents to start thinking about energy, looking at their utility bill, even scheduling tours with their local utility and understanding where does the fuel come from and what are the factors that are set in place that impact my utility bill. But there's not enough everyday people are thinking about energy, and I don't blame them. It's a very difficult topic. Most people just turn on the switch, and that's the most thinking they do about it. And then when you try to start looking at things, it is a little bit complicated because you don't have access to utility executives and you don't understand what decisions they're making that influence your bill at the end of the day. So journalists really are the middlemen between the everyday people and the people in power and the people that sit on the boardrooms for utilities. Those are the spaces where journalists need to be, and they need to disseminate this information in a more direct way to everyday consumers so they really understand, like, what's impacting my utility bill and what can I do to make sure that it's not increasing. Like, right now, across the country, there are utilities who are requesting rate increases from their public service commissioners. That information needs to be disseminated to everyday people, and people need to feel like they have a voice in the process. They should use this voice. They should file a testimony in these rate cases, and they should be more engaged. If we're not engaged as a society, then utilities will continue to do whatever they want, and that will impact us in a negative way.
Selah Goodson-Bell, final thoughts?
Yeah, that was well said. I don't have much to add, and I just want to echo that last point that Shelby was talking about of basically opening up the Pandora's box of what the Public Service Commission is doing and the hearings that they have. Like, these are public hearings that folks, they don't have access to, or like Shelby was saying, they might be talking about topics that feel out of touch, that feel wonky, but no, they're topics that affect people on a daily basis. And I think journalists can do a better job of trying to break those topics down and know that those are spaces where folks need to be. And so trying to uplift folks in those spaces, and then again, also translating a lot of the admittedly wonky topics that we're talking about in a way that everyday people can understand and feel assured to get engaged on, so that they can actually hold these utilities accountable and, again, hold their regulators accountable.
That was Shelby Green from the Energy and Policy Institute and Selah Goodson-Bell from the Center for Biological Diversity, talking about their report, Powerless, which I believe you can still find at bailoutwatch.org. Jane McAlevey passed away this month. She was a critical proponent of organized worker power, an author of books including No Shortcuts, Organizing for Power in the New Gilded Age, and Raising Expectations and Raising Hell. When I spoke with Jane in 2018, the Me Too movement was in the headlines, calling out patriarchy and its protectors in numerous institutions. I asked her for her thoughts about workplace harassment and the role of unions in combating it.
I think several things, I guess, about it. On the one hand, While labor unions may not be in the best position that we've ever been in to take on this crisis, frankly, which is not, as you point out, it's not a new crisis. It's as old as time. It's as old as the patriarchy, right? But the simple fact is they are still, I think, the most effective strategy we have right now for dealing with the kind of abuses that the vast majority of women workers, which is the working class, actually suffer in our country. They are still, warts and all, the best solution to the day-to-day crises that women find themselves in when it comes to sexually harassing employers. And of course, I think it goes well beyond that, too, like, you know, what the narrow confines of what's happening in the workplace. So there's two or three things I was trying to address in the article. I mean, one is, as you pointed out, getting past naming and shaming. I mean, I'm fine with naming and shaming. There is sort of almost a pornographic nature to the naming and shaming. So, like, people are reading all the stories about, you know, this guy did that and blah, blah, blah. But if that's all we do, we are missing a huge moment. And that's what I'm trying to address in the article. So one is sort of in the big picture, what do we do? I argue, in fact, as is the title of my book, No Shortcuts, I don't think that there are any simple solutions. What I was trying to argue in the piece is twofold. One, the labor movement needs to do what I call sort of connecting the dots between this moment and what real solutions look like, which is actually having a trade union so that something like the human resources department of your employer can go from being, frankly, a dangerous place for most women to walk into if they have a sexual harassment claim against their employer, because human resource departments, in fact, are there to defend the employer and make sure that their bosses aren't being sued, except for when you have a union. Because when women have a union, and if the issue is abuse of some kind on the continuum of sexual harassment, whether that's, you know, by the way, disparate pay going on in the workplace or whether it's actual sexual harassment, when women have a union, when you walk into the human resources department, you don't have to walk in alone. You typically are advised never to walk in alone. You've got a union shop steward or some series of coworkers with you because your union contract will actually outline that you are allowed to bring in representatives of your choice from the union. That could be your, you know, your coworker on the job. And you walk in not alone. You walk in with a witness. You walk in with a strategy. You walk in with the power to actually do something about it because it comes from a union negotiated collective agreement. And that is the huge difference between a non-union workplace and a unionized workplace. So that to me is like profound. We're at a place in this country where unions have been so beaten back that, you know, most workers don't have one. So I think they don't understand how to connect, that the best solution still to the Me Too crisis is having a union. And then there's a second issue I'm sort of challenging in the article, which is, you know, that out of the Me Too movement moment, there's really a broader gender equity fight that we need to have in this country that we're basically not having, and that is the fight that I'm challenging the labor movement to have, which is to raise expectations that women in this country, and men for that matter, of all people, but really women, can fight for and achieve the kind of gender equity that our sisters in most of Western Europe have achieved decades before us, like universal child care, universal health care, you know, income supports that allow women to be meaningful participants in the labor force. So it's a two-part sort of article trying to call attention to both issues.
You know, I keep coming back on this show to the idea of vision. And one of the things you say in the piece is that, you know, these things like paid maternity and paternity care and free child care and free health care, it's not pie in the sky. As you noted, other countries have these things, but you have to be able to imagine it in order to fight for it. You know?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I think not only is it not pie in the sky, it's also, I mean, whether you're watching a Michael Moore movie, you know, the Where to Invade Next, or, I mean, we have to remind ourselves this isn't pie in the sky. And going back to the last time I was on your show, which was for my book, Raising Expectations and Raising Hell, you know, I'm calling for the labor movement to, like, raise the expectations bar here. Let's set up a set of demands that really get people excited about what we're calling for, which goes way beyond a $15 an hour wage, which, by the way, most women in the two fields I've worked most in, of education and healthcare, are already beyond a $15 an hour wage. What they need is free child care. What they need is control of their schedule. What they need is maternity and paternity leave, right? So I'm calling on the labor movement to, like, step it up to, like, a much larger vision of where we need to go as a movement. And I think the third dot I'm trying to connect at the end of the story is that, You know, look, it's time for the, you know, the Women's March that's coming up again, right, the anniversary of the huge Women's March last year. I'm also sort of challenging the women's movement in this country to get behind and embrace the idea that unions, in fact, are essential. While they are still the biggest single force inside of sort of the progressive tent, they are really, we're really slammed and flat on our backs right now. So what we need is the kind of energy of millions of women marching with a whole bunch of new banners that say the solution to, like, gender equity and sexual harassment, you know, is actually having a good union. If we think of it, unions are also the largest women's organization in this country. Like, in fact, we are numerically the largest women's organization. But unions, let's face it, we are under profound attack. We've been under profound attack. We're under profound attack again under the Trump administration. There's a series of devastating legal rulings coming up. So, you know, in the article, I call on the Emily's List of the world and all of the PACs, political action committees, you know, that are gender-focused to, like, embrace that a core litmus test of any endorsement by any kind of women's-focused organization or women's-focused political action committee has to be absolutely defending and expanding the right of trade unions to exist in this country, because that's what's going to get us things like universal child care.
And, you know, neither of us are deluded about the issues internal to unions that are problematic and that are troubling, and it's not about ignoring that, you know. But you're talking about walking in alone, and that seems to me to go right to this Murphy Oil case. And I wonder if you can explain this Supreme Court case that listeners may not have heard anything about. You know, the Supreme Court heard it in October. It was kind of a one-day story. What's going on with National Labor Relations Board versus Murphy Oil?
A lot of gender equity has happened in the past. Some of the biggest, most important equal rights in terms of wages decisions that have come down in this country have been through women taking class action lawsuits, right? So what's interesting is at the exact moment when a lot of women might be deciding to stand up and say, we want to sue an employer over some gross persistent sexual harassment, the Murphy Oil case is going to actually prevent women from doing so. It'll become legal. It's never been legal before. It'll become legal. Assuming that the justices do a 5-4 ruling in Murphy, workers will now be forced to sign contracts that read like your cell phone contract in 3-point font buried on page 12 of some rolled up agreement, or, you know, your washing machine, right? It's like workers as a consumer washing machine. It's going to prevent non-union workers, I should be clear, from taking action against their employer. Oddly, it underscores the need for unions. Now, I'm not silly enough to think that, you know, look, the Trump administration has a tenfold plan to kill unions. But they're not just coming after unions. They're coming after the right of all workers, which I think is why they go after unions, right? And that's what Murphy Oil is. So it's going to do something else, we believe, which is eliminate what's called Section 7 protections under the National Labor Relations Act, which means it's essentially very legalistic stuff, which boils down to, since 1935 in this country, under the National Labor Relations Act, all workers, regardless of whether or not they were trying to form a union or not, had what was called protection for concerted activity, which means if a bunch of workers get together to try and resolve something on the job collectively, they were protected from being fired. That provision, we believe, is also going to be stripped away from the law, assuming Murphy Oil is a 5-4 ruling, which is what we assume it will be. And that is going to try and basically, it's got like a bullseye on the alt-labor movement.
And the alt-labor movement, that's folks will be thinking about Fight for 15 or, you know, groups like Make the Road that are not themselves
Restaurant
unions.
Opportunity Center, exactly. All the groups that have been showing some real success, they've been heavily using Section 7 protections under the Act, but not in the cause of forming a union. If Murphy Oil goes through, we believe that they're going to strip Section 7 protections, which ironically will push people back to only having concerted activity protection if they are trying to form a union, which is sort of weird, except, again, we know that with the other mechanisms of anti-trade union behavior that the Trump administration is, you know, like stripping all the enforcers from the National Labor Relations Board. They're not going to exactly make it easy to have protection from the National Labor Relations Act, even if they are trying to form a union, right? Which is why my lifelong argument is it's going to take a whole lot of internal organizing as well as community support to rebuild the labor movement, which is just the support we need right now from the women's movement.
I do think that people are genuinely interested, some of them for the first time, in how to make change happen, you know, how to actually do organizing, not to be confused with tweeting your opinions or sharing a story on Facebook. Perfectly legit exercises in themselves, just not the same thing as organizing. I remember Alicia Garza talking about being in people's living rooms knee to knee, you know, and you
have to have
also a theory of change. You have to be thinking about how change actually happens, right?
Yes, and I think knee-to-knee is perfect. You know, I mean, we talk a lot about face-to-face organizing. A lot of people say to me, you know, well, Jane, in the era of social media, why do we have to do face-to-face organizing? And, you know, the truth is there is no way that by establishing a tweeting relationship with someone that you're going to be able to help carry that person through a deeply fearful moment. And fear is the weapon of choice, not just by union busters, but since you mentioned Alicia Garza, right, whether it's institutionalized police forces, whether it's whatever the mobilization that we're doing is, whether it's Standing Rock, right? I mean, fear is the weapon of our opposition. And for people to get past fearful moments, they generally need to have built face-to-face, knee-to-knee solidarity with the people that they're in the struggle with. And that's a part of what organizing is.
That was Jane McAlevey speaking with Counterspin in 2018. And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Riley Baer. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
You forgot to say who you are and with what band.
Yeah, I know. Hello, this is Reza from Le Vent du Nord. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
It's a Sunday morning, and you're listening to the Jazz Corner here on WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm Kevin Amos. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're listening to the Jazz Corner here on WRCT Pittsburgh. My name is Kevin Amos, and I'm your host for the program, as I'm here every Sunday from 6 a.m. until noon, playing jazz in the first couple of hours. Then we go to blues and R&B, and then we get into like reggae and African music and other world music there for you. So bear with me. We're going to go down the list of what we heard so far today. And let's see what we got. We have coming up, we got some Grover Washington Jr. and Dexter Gordon, possibly some Eugenie Jones. The last thing we heard was Mulgrew Miller doing It Never Entered My Mind. Also, Thelonious Monk doing a version of Blue Monk, taking it back there to a release from 1964. Yeah. Also, Emmanuel Wilkins with Matty Glaze. That's new music from Emmanuel on Blue Note. And we also had new music from Oscar Peterson. Oscar Peterson. And that was, I believe, from a concert from 1964 that has just been put out there again. The original, I don't think it was ever released, or was it released in a different version? But there's a new version for you to check out, especially a lot of you new listeners and new people to check it out, jazz music. So that's what we have so far, and we have more coming up, so stay with us, okay? Yeah, all right.
DJ Firefly, it's time for Couch Dancing on WRCT Pittsburgh. Starting off this show with Disappear and the tune Like Sand from the recent release Iniquity. You should be able to see the whole playlist online at WRCT.org.